years ago, the Dalai Lama was in Bodh Gaya in northern India, the place where the Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree and awakened. And he was going to give a talk to yogis, practitioners like ourselves, in a meditation hall, not much larger than this one. And he was quiet for a long, long, long time. At first everyone was sort of settling in. And they could kind of sense, like, there was a different kind of waiting happening. And finally he said, "Oh, confusion already." And then he was silent for a while, and then he kind of got going, and then it was really good. Yeah, I can kind of relate. I want to speak about the head center this evening. And as I was sitting reflecting, did you ever have a brain fry in your head where thoughts can seize in meditation practice, and sometimes your head just stops working because you just had dinner, and so I had to go and throw my head into the lake. And that helps, since the head is actually part of the body. We sometimes forget, right? So our head, our poor head, needs a lot of body, actually, to function optimally, or at all. Yes, in my case. Okay, let's do a little scientific poll here. How many here have had these kind of thoughts today? Should I leave my relationship or stay? Should I have one more piece of bread or not? Should I do metta practice or breathing practice? That kind of, should I do this or should I do that? How many? Up with hands. Right, you can look around. Just look around and have a sense of it. Okay, how many have had any kind of worrying thoughts? Like, how will my life be? Okay, happens. Right. How many thoughts of desire of any kind? Okay. Yeah. Any aversion? Yep. Because of all this going on, our minds tend to get a bad reputation as being trouble. One of my really dear friends, and he's truly, shouldn't touch the microphone, truly dear, dear friends, he started a center and then a festival in Sweden, so Anne knows well about it. It's a wonderful festival called the No Mind Festival. And when this name was presented, I said, like really? Like no mind? Like really? It's like beautiful mind or true mind, but no mind? I mean, I like to keep mine. I don't know how you feel about it. But it's a great festival. It is. It's interesting that the first step on the Eightfold Path is understanding. What is understanding? What is it that we can understand? Why is that the first step on the path? What did the Buddha intend there? I could wonder. The second step is intention, or orienting oneself in accordance with what one understands. So I like to chew on this a little bit tonight. So in practice, particularly sitting meditation practice, is one of the functions of sitting meditation practice, is that we can begin to study the function of our mind. And quite often, it can seem like the madness of our mind. So one thing we can notice, for instance, is that our mind is less creative than we think it is. It tends to go in loops. Yeah, you notice that. So, when something is important, there's a certain charge, something we really care about. So, one of these choices in life, should I go left, should I go right? And it's really important to our heart, but since we're not quite feeling it there, then we go up in the mind and we say, should I go left or should I go right? Maybe I should go left, maybe I should go right. And then it goes the same loop again and again and comes back a little bit later. And it comes back because of the charge. And actually, this kind of function of thinking can't help it because it's only based on what we already know. It's just based on the information we have on our history. It cannot go outside of that. So we repeat the same kind of thought, the same kind of thought, the same kind of worry. So when we stop for a moment and we actually feel the worry, then something starts to open up on the level of mind. And this is something you can try, you can apply. Another thing that the mind does, in Pali it's called prapancha, it's the tendency to, you think one thought, or in contact with just about any experience, thoughts grow exponentially. Vroom. Once I drove my car, I passed by a police control, and I observed myself racing through a series of scenarios and possibilities. So the police car was just standing there doing a control of another car. First I felt relieved. Like, whew. And then I thought, that's so interesting. Why am I relieved? What have I done? And then I started, winter tires? Check. Okay. Car functioning? Did I pay the pollution tax and all of those things? Check. And then it went all the way to, have I been drinking? For sure I had not been drinking. But never mind, the mind goes there. Isn't that interesting? Boom, 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 boom. The classical example in the Buddhist tradition is you walk on a path in the forest and there is a snake on the ground, and help, you're going to die, you're going to get bitten, but it's not a snake, it's just a stick. So there is something beautiful about our capacity to associate mind proliferation. But it puts us in great trouble, right? Because we run far, far away from actual lived experience. No wonder we feel a bit crazy at times, right? One of my absolutely closest friends, this afternoon, when we did the loving kindness practice, just short while before, his wife went into surgery, and a quite serious surgery, operating away the womb with suspicion of cancer. And I haven't heard the results yet, what they found. Before the operation, the doctors didn't know. But what has been so beautiful for me, several things, but one thing in particular is that when they found out this in the beginning of the summer, and all their summer plans went like they do, and lots of tests and doctor's appointments, they really stayed grounded. So this tendency for the mind to explode into fear thinking of all the things that can happen. So when our survival instinct is triggered, this proliferation of mind tends to happen where we just explode out in fear. They actually really just stayed with, we don't know, this is terrifying, but here we are. And what I saw from them was that their contact deepened. Like everything got really sweeter and more precious. And then what was also really touching for me was that just this morning, so I got this mail. I do check my mail. So I got a mail saying, please send loving kindness to us as we go into surgery. And it touched me that at this time, they also had a sense of the potency of kindness and having lots of heart. And actually calling in friends and family, and friends all over, to really participate in being there, so to speak, in being in contact. So practice has real power when applied, true power. And our mind has this power to remain at ease and open in the face of tremendous challenge, for real. So the things that truly matter to us, that are dear to our hearts, I think it's important to take them serious. We have a tendency when we go up in our minds to get really impatient, like it should already be solved. It's like kids saying, are we there yet? It's like, are we there yet? And when you're not, you're not. So, well, maybe... And I go hiking with my kids. It's like, are we there yet? And it's like, look around. Obviously not. One of my teachers, not in the Buddhist tradition, in the Advaita Vedanta tradition, Punja, died quite some years ago. One of his best advices when it came to this territory, he would just say, just shut up. Just be quiet. That works too sometimes. So problems, these things that matter to our heart, they only leave you once they taught you what you need to know. So when you kind of, you know, chew on something and you just go over it in that loop again and again and again. More often than not, it's like when we complain and we say, I've been trying to solve this for so long, I've been thinking about this for so long. More often than not, it actually needs to come closer. Because often how we try to deal with something is like, okay, let me solve it, but a little bit at a safe distance, so I don't have to feel it so much. It's like, yeah, should I go left or right? Oh, I don't know. I don't want to feel it. I recognize that. Need to let it in. I think often when it comes to us and us as a mind-centered culture, we underestimate the importance of direct experience, felt experience. We make things too abstract, too generalized, rather than personal, rather than here and now. So wisdom can come from unexpected areas. I was sitting in a plane and I was reading an article by a food critic going to different restaurants and giving food reviews. And his name was Calvin Trillin, and he said, "For years, my mother served us nothing but leftovers, and the original meal has never been found." Quite often in life, it's like that, right? We turn to something, and then it's like, what's the cause of this? But it's too complex. We can't quite sort it. So understanding is something quite different than trying to figure it out and finding that original cause. And with the belief that when we figure out the original meal, then somehow magically everything will just settle and be fine. So I think one thing that we really need in practice is a spirit of curiosity and a willingness to dare to experiment a bit. We can become a bit fearsome to do it right. It's like we all been a bit damaged by schooling, it seems. Like, am I doing it right? And it has a way of dampening down practice, actually. You know, one could say that, you know, there are no mistakes. It's just learning. We have to expose ourselves to experience to be able to find out left or right. This little stanza of story. So the practitioner came to the fearsome Zen master and said, Master, what's the key to happiness? And the master said, what did the master say? Any ideas? Okay, the master said, good judgment. Okay, student was silent for a while and said, okay, how do I get good judgment? And the master said, experience. Okay, how do I get experience? Bad judgment. So when there is love of truth, touched upon yesterday, and some curiosity, what's this? You know, there's one thing to worry and worry and worry and fret and try to make decisions and judge oneself, but it becomes a whole different game when you get curious about it. It's like, isn't this really interesting that I'm beating myself up all the time? What's going on there? Isn't this interesting that... Curiosity is a great friend in practice. Actually, in the Buddhist tradition, there isn't really so much division between heart and mind. It's seen as one system. as one organ, one could say, as one capacity, citta. And this is how we function best. Our discriminating mind needs the love of truth. We need a lot of heart for our mind to function optimally. It needs to be filled with heart quality. It's the heart that gives the mind its sensitivity, capacity to respond appropriately. And so often this association we have with the mind as filled with stuff and history and knowledge. But actually, of course, we as beings, we consist mainly of water. And if it's not water, it's a lot of space, an atomic space. If we really look in detail at human physicality, mostly we're walking space, which is really strange. But then we're also walking water. And the organs that contain the most water is the heart and the brain. I like to remember that sometimes. It's like, oh, it's just liquid up there. It's just kind of just sloshing around. And it kind of's like, oh, yeah. This idea that it's, you know, filled with stuff, that's not true. It's like you and the lake. In many traditions, of course, the nature of mind is described as skylight. It's like sky, endless, open sky. Like living, clear daylight. And thoughts, just like a little flash passing by. No big deal. Just a little kind of nothing, has no substance. Thoughts have no substance, right? Just a little, just a few words. In this vast openness. And of course, it's hard to recognize something that we're rarely taught exists, that is not valued. But I think each one of us have had a taste of when the mind quiets down and becomes like still water. Have you felt sometime when you get a really good idea? And the mind starts to feel brilliant. It's almost like dazzling light or light on water. It's like, whoa! And it can be something simple, but you get a great idea. Huh? Do you recognize that? It kind of lights up inside. It's like, whoa! The lights went on. Much as the heart has this rich, open capacity, the true nature of the mind is this open, spacious brilliancy. We think of all these firings in the brain. If you just think of all these electrical impulses, right? There is beauty in that. So practice can teach us that the proper functioning of our mind is not so much a hindrance for our life as something that can be in service of awakening. Service for truth. And that starts to approach this first step on the Eightfold Path, understanding. A spirit of inquiry that comes equally from heart as from mind. I think one reason why I like poems in these kind of situations is because it has a way of communicating that sometimes shakes up the mind a little bit, because poems, although they communicate understanding, goes via a different route than facts. Factual knowledge. So here's T.S. Eliot, that kind of spirit of curiosity and the process of understanding. We shall not cease from exploring, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started, and know the place for the first time. Through the unknown, unremembered gate, when the last of earth left to discover is that which was the beginning, at the source of the longest river, the voice of the hidden waterfall, and the children in the apple tree, not known because not looked for, but heard, half heard, in the stillness. Between two waves of the sea, quick, now, here, now, always, a condition of complete simplicity, costing no less than everything. And all shall be well, all manners of things shall be well. It's very much what can happen when we stop and we pay attention and become aware. A condition of complete simplicity, costing exactly all our heart, all our presence. And in that, something can be heard. An understanding can start to emerge. Often we have the idea that understanding is something external that has to kind of be downloaded. And of course, we do share teaching because it matters. We share in small group meetings because we share human wisdom and we share experience together, so we can learn from each other and be inspired. That is important. But understanding is not downloadable. It arises from within, from our direct experience, and involves the heart and the mind. And understanding sometimes is just like, ah. It may not be quite formulated yet, but you just know that's true. There was something about that that was true. Understanding is not always clearly formulated, but it can be. And that too is a practice. In fact, the third step on the Eightfold Path. To begin to formulate what is true, because in the articulation we understand more. So that's another step, and we'll be practicing that more towards the end of the retreat. So most of the time, of course, our experience of heart-mind is just based on our psychodynamic history, on ego, on that amoeba-like contraction, desire, worry, aversion, trying to control, make it all okay. It's a universe made into objects and fixed when it's not, when it's fluid. So it's like the ego, and you may have met a person or two, it's like our ego tries to claim all that capacity in the mind, all the brain power, tries to claim it but can't quite operate the vehicle. It's like, oh, there's a lot of brilliancy here. It's like, oh, I'm worried. I'm really worried. And just, it's like sitting in a spaceship, I guess, but you're just, you know, you're not equipped to run it. You know, the ego, because the ego is a defense system without the core, it's really hard for the ego. You know, it's a terrible thing to know you kind of don't exist, but you're really trying your best to kind of look like you're something. So our ego needs a lot of compassion in its judgment and sometimes in its grandiosity, you know, like looking good, doing it right, here, look at me. You know, it's like the ego always goes from inflation to deflation. It's like, hmm? And then there is this vast sky-like oceanic brilliancy. And then this little ego that's a kind of nothing. No wonder it gets stressed. Try and contain all of that. One of the best remedies here is the sacred art of the don't know mind. We're so quick to try to find solutions and conclusions. You know, how often have we not all, even if it's the first retreat, but you've probably already done it. It's like, how can I solve this? How can I feel my heart more? Or how can I stop thinking? It's like we try to think more about the solution instead of making the sacred statement of I don't know. The don't know mind just opens possibilities. It's like I don't know. It's a beautiful state. It's like the Dalai Lama, confusion already. Seems like he fully embraced it. You know, I don't think there was anyone that was sitting listening to him that thought, you know, don't want to listen to you. It kind of, you know, made us love him more because he was real. He was just there with his experience, happened to be confusion. So I don't know. I don't know puts us in contact again. It gives us that extra breath, like, interesting, no solution. Do we dare to hang out there at the edge of the unknown? Don't know. It's like my friends. Could be cancer. We don't know. We have to wait once the uterus is out. Better to just stay present. No point in speculating, because we don't know. T.S. Eliot here again. I said to my soul, be still and wait without hope. For hope would be the hope for the wrong thing. Wait without love, for love would be the love of the wrong thing. There is yet faith, but the faith and the love and the hope are in the waiting. Wait without thought, because you're not ready for thought. So the darkness shall be the light, and the stillness the dancing. So perhaps our practice can be a lot like showing up and waiting and paying attention, not waiting from that numb, bored place, but waiting wide open, listening, sensing. My son, I don't know if I'm there, if I'm allowed to say this, but my son recently had his first kiss, and like a real kiss, you know, and you know that moment, like just the moment before you're kissed, when it's somebody that you really want to kiss, that moment, and you're just there. Like everything is present. I remember our cat. There's a kitten and indoors, and then there was a spring day. We thought, okay, let's let the cat out. And the little cat stepped out, and we were sitting outside, and the fur just went and you could see the cat just taking in, whoa, sky and everything. And the cat just stood there like, it's like, okay, now what? What if you sit down on the cushion and you just go, boof? Oh, boredom! How interesting! There can be a real freshness in our mind, clear, cool, calm freshness, fully operational, so to speak, fully functional. You know, so there's an interesting thing that can start to happen. You know, one of the great capacities of our mind is the capacity to discriminate, to recognize patterns. And it can go all the way from there to recognizing inherent knowing, the unfabricated, the quiet, clear, spacious mind recognizes what is true about existence, together with the heart. The nature of mind is pure awareness. And that kind of mind starts to make our experience much more transparent. We feel more transparent, more permeable. Things can pass through, just like the sound when the bell rings. It actually passes through us. Have you noticed in the field of awareness? It just passes through. Vroom, 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 vroom. Things can start to pass through us. We become mind-filled, the field of awareness. So the mind has the capacity to take us from knowledge to pure mystery. The silent knowing, the silent understanding. The understanding about the truth of suffering and the end of suffering, when we stop the amoeba motion of contracting and defending and clinging on to all this watery existence that just keeps on flowing, cannot be grasped, to the understanding that is just absolutely still. So mind can become our true friend. And it's good, you know, the way we're stacked. So there is lower part of the body, belly, at least in my case, and then there is heart. The heart needs a lot of belly. And then comes the mind. It needs this kind of alignment to function properly. Take away one, and it will work. And there's something interesting that happens when this alignment is there. The way our mind starts to work, it actually works in the heart and in the belly. There's a particular kind of understanding that it can happen from the belly, the gut feeling. There's a particular kind of understanding that happens in the heart. And the clear comprehension that can happen in an untroubled mind that doesn't waste energy on unnecessary worrying or complaining. So lucky for us, we don't need to understand so many things. I think it was Gandhi that said, "Live as if you will die tomorrow, but learn as if you will live forever." I really like that. There was a time as a practitioner where I was a little bit more narrow. So it was like, okay, it's all about spiritual practice, and I was very serious about it. And then over the years, I've come to appreciate the joy of learning, just learning something. This is wonderful, like we can learn new things. We may not have use for them, doesn't matter. There is a particular joy in learning that actually opens the mind. An innocence in learning. So, well, how does this work? And there then comes the second step on the Eightfold Path, that is not a linear path, it's sort of like a hologram, multifunctional. The importance of intention. And this is important because with all the things that we care about, and then when we get a little bit preoccupied in our mind and we try to solve something, mostly what we need to do is to feel how much we care. Let's say, should I change my job or not? I don't know. I don't know how to decide. Should I go left? Should I go right? Mostly what needs to happen is to recognize, oh, there is worry. Then feel, what is the intention in the heart? I care. I care about my life. I care a great deal. to feel the intention. I want it to be good. I want my work, as an example, to be meaningful, to be of use. When we feel that intention in the heart, and here's the art then, planting the seed and then hands off. If we start to kind of, oh, how is it going? You know how it is when you plant seeds. You have to let them be in the ground and germinate. Just have to let them stay there until they sprout. Intentions can be planted. It's what we do in metta practice in a way also, wishing ourselves well, wishing for the things that matter for us. We plant seeds, and then we have to let them be. Then we have to let the mind rest. The job is done. Then it's the waiting. The waiting without hope, because the hope that the mind starts to think about is not the right hope. We have to let our waiting be that bare. Okay. Basta. Almost. Here's a kind of statement of intention I came across that I think is beautiful. So maybe you can see how it speaks to you and then plant your own intention seeds tonight. I will not live an unlived life. I will not live in fear of falling or catching fire. I choose to inhabit my days to allow my living to open me, to make me less afraid, more accessible, to loosen my heart until it becomes a wing, a torch, a promise. I choose to risk my significance, to live so that which came to me as seed goes to the next as blossom, and that which came to me as blossom goes on as fruit. May our minds be at peace. May the many seeds of our heart's intention enrich our lives and be for the good of all beings. May all beings awaken to their true nature.